What I'm going to present to you today is possibly a little different direction of what we've been going towards, but I want you to appreciate, or hopefully you can appreciate by the end, why studying unique model systems that do unique things can provide to our understanding of basic biology and possibly therapeutics. So the system that I work on is the axolotl salamander, which you'll learn plenty of by the end of this talk. And what's amazing about these guys is they regenerate entire limbs as well as other organs. And what we're trying to understand is, you know, how does a cell that's located here know that it's here and regenerate only elbow and a hand, or if you cut an arm off at the radius ulna, how does it know to regenerate just a hand? That's just a kind of a basic overview of what we're trying to do. So obviously I'm not the first person to think of why certain animals regenerate so well. So this goes back to Charles Bonnet, the inventor of the homunculus, that shows a monograph in 1777 describing how a salamander regenerates its arm. So it shows the process. And this was kind of where we were locked in for hundreds of years, is observation, cutting and slicing, seeing how do these animals regenerate just at the visual level. We're just getting into the genetics on how this is done. And a lot of the same questions that were asked back then are still asked today. So Lazzaro Spallanzani, one of the fathers of experimental biology in 1768, was the first to describe salamander regeneration. But if salamanders regenerate their limbs, even when kept on dry ground, how comes it to pass that other land animals are not endued with the same power? So many of the same questions we ask today were asked hundreds of years ago. But I think these questions are more relevant than ever in today's biomedical and bioengineering market, where by understanding regenerative biology, or how certain animals can regenerate better than others, we might be able to inform regenerative medicine, or the burgeoning field of regenerative medicine, where the goal is to either grow organs and dishes or induce a latent regenerative response that's laying dormant in our cells. So currently, where kind of the field lies, and it's next week could be different on how fast this field moves, is we're great at making tubes and bags, right? Tracheas, bladders, things like that. But trying to regenerate a complex structure as a brain or a spinal cord or a limb, we're relatively poor at. So this is what I think we can learn. If we can figure out how these animals can do it, we might be able to at least inform regenerative medicine and how to better regenerate complex structures. So into the model organism of what I work on. I call it a model organism. It's relatively new, and some of you might not have seen it. I saw it at the Chicago Zoo this weekend, which I was happy about. So this is a Mexican axolotl. They grow up to over a foot long. They're indigenous to the lake Mexico City was built on, Lake Xochimilco. So they're a large aquatic animal, so they don't undergo metamorphosis. Like you think of a salamander running around, looks like a lizard. They look like more like a large tadpole with gills and stay swimming in fish tanks for their entire lives. But what's even more amazing about these guys is they regenerate practically everything that doesn't kill them, beyond limbs. So they can regenerate their gills if they're cut off. They can regenerate parts of their eye, retina, lens, parts of their lower jaw, even large portions of their heart they can regenerate, as long as it's functionally intact. And what's even more amazing is that they can regenerate parts of their central nervous system relatively well. So parts of their frontal lobe can be cut out, and they can regenerate that structure. Even more amazing is scissors can be taken across the back of an animal over a foot long, and it's paralyzed from the trunk down. But within 2-3 months, they make all the new neurons, all the new connections to regain function of their lower limbs, which is pretty incredible. And then beyond that, they regenerate limbs, the more classic system of complex tissue regeneration. So I think one of the best ways to appreciate how this complex tissue regeneration works is to show how, just visualize it. So this is a movie put on by the HHMI showing a time series over 45 days of a regenerating salamander limb. So you can see that was amputated here and it can regrow a completely, fully functional new limb. So what's really neat is if you go in and look closer at these limbs, they're relatively similar to yours and I's. So it has humerus, radius ulna, digits, cartilage, tendons, skin, all the same structures. But what happens very differently is when you cut this off. So you see some scissors come in, lop it off, and it's things change, diverge between mammals and salamanders very quickly. As the epidermis closes off very quickly compared to what happens to you and I. Within 24 hours, you'll close off a wound injury. And what also happens is right underneath that wound epidermis, you have activation of local lineage-restricted stem cells. So the bone contributes, the muscle, the skin, the dermis, and nerves. And interactions between the skin and the nerves supply all the factors necessary for tell those cells to grow and divide and turn into what's essentially a limb bud during development. It just recapitulates development, grows faster than the rest of the animal, and you have complete replacement of the limb, which you can see because the salamander is waving at us, it's fully functional. So what I'm trying to get at is to develop the tools and to start to address this question at the molecular and cellular level. So I'm asking the simple question, what is the cellular and molecular basis of complex tissue regeneration? So our approach is relatively straightforward, but there's a lot of hurdles when you work on a system that's classically not a model system like a fly or a mouse. First, we need to discover the actual genes in the axolotl genome, which you'll find out in the next slide how we did it. Identify the gene candidates that may regulate the complex regeneration process. And then we need to be able to functionally test these genes, so develop the actual tools to functionally test gene candidates. And then finally, get into testing across taxa of making mouse models versus axolotl models so we can test for conservation of animals that do regenerate versus don't regenerate. So first we'll go over how we developed or identified many of the genes in the axolotl genome. So this is a simple graph here. On the left is the number of genes discovered, or with 20,000 being the approximate number of genes in the vertebrate genome, and the number of sequence reads we've discovered over time. So my early research career has kind of followed the level of next-gen sequencing, where very early sequencing was very expensive, very slow, and over time it's become so much more rapid that we've been able to discover what we think of as 95% coverage of the axolotl transcriptome. We're finding many of the genes are the same, highly conserved, but they do have some unique genes that possibly could play a role in regeneration. But the point of this is that a lot of our early work was to generate a lot of the genome resources for the axolotl genome. And through those genome resources, we were able to develop the tools to see which genes regulate regeneration. So I generate affymetrix microarrays or use next-gen sequencing to do transcriptomics. And what this allowed us to do is by generating the genomic tools to identify transcription, we were able to see what genes are actually turning on or turning off during spinal cord regeneration, or also during limb regeneration, which genes are turning on and off during limb regeneration. So I won't go over the list of many stories we have of how many genes are on or off, what they're doing. I'll go over a more specific problem that's lingered in the field since 1823 and is more relevant to a lot of the questions that are asked here. So this is the nerve dependency of limb regeneration. So Tweed Judd Todd, in 1823, was on a boat off of Italy, got his hand on some salamanders, and wrote a monograph basically on regeneration, but one of his key findings was, if the nerve be intersected at the time of amputation, regeneration is entirely prevented. So what that means is he just cut the brachial nerves, so the major nerves that come from the motor nerves and sensory nerves that innervate all of our limbs. If you denervate that or cut those three major nerves, the limb's denervated and it will not regenerate. So there's something that some communication that comes from the nervous system to the limb that's necessary for regeneration. One of the easiest examples to show this is that intact nerve, 11 days post-amputation, you see a little limb bud there, that this is the regenerating limb, versus the denervated limb that only has a limb stump there, so that's not regenerating. Now this isn't just unique to limb regeneration. This is an axolotl salamander brain that also regenerates that had a large portion of its frontal lobes. Here's its large frontal lobes. If you cut a segment out here and cut the olfactory bulb, the aponeurons that are innervating into the brain, this also doesn't regenerate. So it's not unique to a limb. It's also related to the central nervous system. And it even is conserved down from sea stars up to mammals. So innervation of mammalian wounds is also needed. Proper innervation is needed for mammalian wounds to us.
Can I have a question?
Yes.
So I'm not really understanding the cartoon that we saw before, because didn't it look like you were just snipping the entire limb on and do that? So that presumably didn't have intact nerve, right?
No, it does. So what I mean is the nerves are, after amputation, nerves, the cut nerves right at the end, regenerate quickly into the limb. So they permeate throughout the entire limb, into the epidermis, into the mesenchyme. So they are intact. What I mean is if you cut the nerve at the beginning of the limb, you've essentially denervated the limb. So if you cut the nerve here and amputate here, this limb doesn't have nerves. So one of the key questions that drive our research program is to ask what factor is the nerve supply to support regeneration. And this has been studied for almost 100 years, going back to 1923, and was majorly, most often studied in the 1940s and 1950s by a gentleman named Marcus Singer, who showed that a couple factors are hypothesized to describe this factor. It's supply, it's generated in the motor neurons and the sensory neurons within the central nervous system, is moved down the axons and supplied locally to the limb. So through our genomic studies and through classic comparisons to developmental biology, several factors have come up that could be the factor supplied by the nervous system into the limb to support regeneration. Through our studies and others, neuregulin 1, that codes for glial growth factor, which many people have probably heard of, is the most likely candidate in our opinion. So when I had my own lab, this was the first thing we were going after. So three things likely are essential or needed to show that this neuregulin 1 might be the nerve-derived factor. One, it needs to be produced by the nerves. Two, administration of neuregulin locally within a limb should rescue a denervated limb. And three, inhibition of neuregulin 1 signaling should block regeneration. So first things to go over is neuregulin signaling. So it's a very important signaling pathway in all nerve system development, where you have your neuregulin ligand that codes for multiple isoforms that are either secreted by nerves or on the cell surface of nerves that signal to their juxtapin cell type, which oftentimes Schwann cells or epidermal cells, that are expressing this family of receptors, of receptor tyrosine kinases, called ERBBs, ERBB2, ERBB3, which many people here probably know is related with breast cancer and other diseases. So neuregulin ligand binds to these ERBB receptors, activates multiple intracellular signaling cascades, which promotes cell proliferation, differentiation, and multiple downstream effects. So what we've been able to see through immunohistochemistry is that it is indeed expressed in motor neurons, in axons within the central nervous system, the spinal cord here, which looks a little different than the Lamaillian spinal cord you're used to looking at, but that's what an axolotl spinal cord looks like, as well as the sensory nervous system. So this is the dorsal root ganglia. Each of those red cells are Schwann's, sensory neurons that are expressing the neuregulin protein. So what is likely taking place is the protein's generated in the nervous system and sent down to the limb during regeneration. So if this is indeed the case, we should be able to denervate limbs and rescue regeneration if we supply neuregulin locally at the limb, if the nerve is not there. So how we do this, as of now, until we make genetic models to do so, is we soak beads in the drug or not. So these little beads that are used that can take up a lot of protein, so the little blue bead right there is soaked in PBS. That's our control. You can see this denervated limb is not regenerated. But when we soak these same beads in a neuregulin protein overnight, where it takes up large amounts of protein, you see the several beads there, we actually have regeneration in a denervated state, which is, I think, the first time this has been done to this level using this model. So this is really exciting as a new lab that we've come across this so quickly. And when we quantify this across multiple animals, we see that it's highly significant that we are rescuing regeneration by supplying neuregulin locally at the limb in a denervated state. So our third criteria that we need to make is that inhibition of neuregulin 1 signaling through ERBB receptors should block regeneration. So how we do this is a classic pharmacological approach, which is one of the approaches we've used so far, and we're getting into using it genetically, is to just inhibit ERBB2 receptor kinase activity using an ERBB2 specific inhibitor and show that we can block regeneration. So this is 11 days after amputation, you have a regenerating limb in an innervated control. But our innervated limb, so this has nerves in it, but is blocking the cingulate from neuregulin to ERBB, also has block regeneration and mimics a denervated limb. So when we quantify this, we also have a high a statistical significance between multiple concentrations at a low concentration of 100 nanomolar of our inhibitor, 500 nanomolar, which is not significantly different than our denervated controls. And we do have, which is highly significantly different than our innervated controls. So this seems that we have met all three criteria that we'd like to put forward on identifying the nerve-derived factor. So our current model is that neuregulin ligands supplied by nerve fibers to ERBB receptors are essential for limb regeneration. So we think that based upon those earlier models, that neuregulin is supplied within the nervous system, set down axons, and is activating local ERBB receptors that are expressed during limb regeneration, which support cell proliferation. Cell proliferation is based off of an old model that's been shown many times over. When you denervate a limb, cells just stop dividing. So this is why the downstream effect is cell proliferation and hence limb regeneration. So one of the issues is this is telling a great story on the mechanisms, but how do we get at being able to screen beyond putting beads in limbs and whatnot and just showing at the protein levels and borrowing all the drugs that have been developed? It's that we need to develop axolotl transgenics. So this was a large component of my last couple of years, is to develop transgenics in this system. So what we've done is we can kind of build a modular system that allows us to generate transgenics in the axolotl. So what's cool about these animals, they lay 600 to 900 eggs at a time, and they're all about 2 millimeters across. You can practically inject an egg by hand under a dissection scope, which is, these are some of the largest eggs out of vertebrates. So what we can do is inject naked DNA into an axolotl egg, which it will be randomly take up our transgene of interest. And then from that point on, every cell will be transgenic, which has allowed us to develop the first transgenic reporter axolotl that's ever been developed in this past year.
Is this just by recombination?
No, this is by random integration. It's basically using techniques developed in zebrafish and xenopus. So once we have our transgenic approaches developed, we thought we needed to develop some way of allowing us to screen when cells are stuck in the cell cycle, where they're stuck in the cell cycle, or what happens to cells after we put a drug in the water or denervate or whatnot. So what we've developed in our lab is borrowed from a fantastic approach developed at the Riken Institute by the Miyaoka lab, which is called FUCI, fluorescence ubiquitination-based cell cycle indicator. So that long term actually just means cells that are in G1 glow red, cells that are in G2 and SG2 and M glow green. So what that allows us to do is if we put a ubiquitous promoter driving these cell cycle reporters, all the cells that are in G1 glow red, all the cells that are in S phase, G2 and M glow green, and we can track cell division in vivo, in real time, during regeneration. So this is a regenerating limb bud here, where all your cells in G1, which is your cartilage and bone, are glowing red, and then all your cells in your blastema, which are rapidly dividing, are glowing green, so in SG2M phase. So really excited about using this approach to understand the actual cellular basis of our nerve dependency question. So hopefully you can see this. This is a little weaker on with all the light in here, but it's fine. So this is a regenerating tail right here, where all the cells in red are in G1. You can then overlay the green channel to show that where cells are actually dividing during regenerating tail. And then we can see, possibly, so this is the bright field overlay, where we can track cell division in these animals and image them multiple times a day to see where cells are dividing. When we put a drug in the water, do these cells stall in a certain phase of the cell cycle? And the last trick that this allows us to do is image in real time. So here's a regenerating limb. You can see in all the growth plates, all the proliferating cells in the growth plates of the limb. But we also get to image cell division in real time. So this is a cell that was in S phase that's going through mitosis and turns off the green. So this was tracked over several hours using this Fuchs construct. So we are very early in the process of developing transgenics in the system, but this is one of the most exciting tools that we can use for possible drug discovery or screening approaches, is that once we have these readouts for cell division, we can see which drugs or which perturbations block cell division. So as a summary, what we're looking at is the unique model system, the axolotl salamander, where we think we have 95% coverage, or at least right now, 95% coverage of the transcriptome. We are studying currently spinal cord regeneration in these animals, as well as the molecular and cellular basis of limb regeneration, and more specifically, trying to understand the role of nerves with limb regeneration. And lastly, we're in the business of generating the tools so we can actually ask these questions in the axolotl. So with that, I wanted to thank my collaborators and mentors. So my PhD advisor, Randall Voss, my postdoc advisor, Malcolm Maiden, and a close collaborator who is also a new investigator at the University of Kentucky, Ashley Seifert, as well as the growing Monahan lab. So Johanna Farkas has done a lot of this early and regular work, who's here today, actually. And speaking of co-op, wonderful, I have a full-time co-op student that has actually been developing this Fuchs model in my system, Eric Rabinowitz. And lastly, I wanted to thank Northeastern University. I'm a new professor, and I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for all of their generous startup funds, developing my animal facilities, which is imaged here. And lastly, although I'm a Midwesterner, like I said at the beginning of the talk, this is me and my daughter in Chicago. We really are appreciative, like meetings like this, of how we are in the middle of all kind of biotech, biomed, and it's really exciting part of being a new assistant professor in Boston. So thank you.
Genome,
you know, but more than one gene copy and all that. Is that true? No, they're not a duplicated genome like a frog or even a zebrafish. They do a very complex genome. The reason why it's not sequenced is 10 times larger than the human genome.
Right, that's what I thought.
But they have the same number of genes, so practically the same number of genes. They don't have it wasn't a recent duplication, genome duplication.
But they do have all sorts of the non-coding.
Yes.
So I'm thinking about my favorite salamander model, which is the Eastern Ute, because I used to raise them, sort of. And they do regenerate.
Right.
You know.
So the Newt's a great model also. The only reason we work on the axolotl is you can't breed Newt's in the lab as of now.
That's right.
So the developing the genetics to address regeneration in the new kind of has a limit. But that has been the strong pushing force of in the salamander regeneration field is the new for the last 100 years.
So I think it might be a little bit confused as to what curriculum and SSB interactions are coming in.
Right.
So when we first got from Lynn, it seems to be an inhibitory effect of teaching that is there, but not inhibited. Because if your own growth is inhibited, it is not actually at the forefront of the information, right? So this actually is happening downstream of whatever has to happen initially to have the regular being sent down lower than us to that to spend the year.
So
the first step is still not what you're addressing. You're addressing the next step.
Right. So, well, this is the first step, as in neuregulin is always produced in nerves. It is upregulated a little bit during regeneration, but it's always produced. And usually, if you have a knockout mouse of neuregulin, the interaction is between the axon and the Schwann cell. Schwann cells usually express ERBB receptors, and that's the interaction. Step one is, if we think when you denervate a limb, you lose the supply of neuregulin. And if you have a knockout mouse of ERBB2, ERBB3, all the Schwann cells die very early on because they don't have that neuregulin supply. So that's, we're trying to get at the mechanism of, is neuregulin signaling directly to Schwann cells, which is then supplying a growth factor. We have also evidence that ERBB receptors are expressed in the epidermis. So the nerves could be going into the epidermis and signaling there that are then supplying the growth factors. This is the most upstream of neuregulin might not be the growth factor that is telling cells to divide, but it is the primary component that is kind of bringing that cascade down. Yeah.
And neuregulin is involved in cancer biology too.
Exactly.
But
that's why there's so many great inhibitors and things. Yeah.
One more question before we go to break.
Quick question on what's the relationship between salamander age and the cascade regeneration?
So what's amazing with these animals, they live up to 20 years, they never get cancer, and even if you put cancer-causing drugs in there, they don't get cancer. They will regenerate through their entire life. It takes longer when you become older, and we have a study in review action right now that if you induce them to metamorphose, which you can do, you just throw thyroid hormone in the water, and they become the adult phase, they don't regenerate as well. They regenerate at half the rate, and they always have missing digits. So they lose the rate and ability, which is, I think, a nice aging model. But they're kind of stuck in a juvenile state. You know, they're perpetually juvenile. They seem healthy. I'm only a decade in this, but I have animals that are practically a decade old. But they do regenerate. They just regenerate a little slower.
All right, we're going to break. We're running. We got started a little late this morning.